You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When is the last time you lost it at work and either cried or yelled? And how might that outburst have affected your professional reputation? A lot of American workers perceive the office as a place where reason should prevail over strong feelings. But as anyone who has ever had a job can attest, you can't clock out of your own emotions when you clock in at work. 3 out of 4 of us have felt frustrated in the past year. Nearly half have experienced anxiety, and 60% have seen their boss blow up at somebody. So how does all this emotion affect our career prospects? And is crying at work still the ultimate no-no? Ann Kramer is former executive vice president and worldwide creative director of Nickelodeon. She's also a one-time columnist for Fast Company and Martha Stewart Living magazines. Her new book is called It's Always Personal, Emotion in the New Workplace. Ann, welcome to Think.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. I want to mention to people that you mention in the book, and there's an online link on the Think page of KERA.org to this thing called the Workplace Emotion Evaluation Profile, so anyone near a computer can take it. We'll come back to that in a minute, but talk for a moment about what we can learn about ourselves in terms of how we cope with emotion at work.
Well, one of the fascinating things for me was I started the sort of journey for this book when a former colleague of mine had said to me at a party, you know, why is it that all women we know had cried at work and wished that we had not? And I thought, why is that? And that led me on this journey to look into the neuroscience of how genders process and deal with emotions. And it was a fascinating thing. I looked at anger and anxiety and fear and joy and compassion. And consistently, in a variety of different ways, the genders, in fact, while they feel emotions in very kind of similar things, they respond and deal with them in different ways.
In fact, women are biologically wired to cry more easily than men.
Yeah, well, one of the shocking things I found out was that our tear ducts, women's tear ducts, are actually anatomically different from men's. So that when we cry, tears tend to stream down our face, where a man might be feeling exactly the same degree of kind of emotional distress or empathy, and yet his eyes only well up because his tear ducts are different. I also found out that women have 6 times the amount of prolactin in their bodies, and prolactin's the hormone that triggers crying. And so it kind of goes on and on from there. There's a whole layers of things that, from my perspective, if we could get kind of rational about what was behind some of our emotional behaviors, it would allow us to sort of develop coping skills for them in a way that might be fresh.
You know, Anne, it's so funny that we expect ourselves to always remain on an even keel at work, because one thing that you discovered is that most workers have a pretty high tolerance for displays of emotion in their colleagues.
Well, it was a really exciting discovery. I did 2 large national surveys, and 88% of all Americans believe that the expression of emotion at work is a positive thing. It's an attribute, and it's a humanizing force. And I think, you know, emotion at work has gotten pigeonholed into 2 different kinds of behavior, both viewed to varying degrees with kind of contempt. One is crying, and the other is anger. And there's a whole range of other emotions, however, though, you know, excitement and joy and, you know, the passion to help the underdog or to improve the world, all sorts of things that still get relegated to this kind of, you know, emotion isn't a wonderful thing to have at work.
You started your investigation with a survey of 701 men and women across a broad geographic and occupational spectrum. What kinds of questions did you ask?
We asked them everything from, you know, have you yourself cried or been angry during the last 12 months? How did you feel before, during, and after those experiences? Have you observed other people, you know, expressing anger or in tears at work? How did you feel about them before, during, and after those experiences? To try and get a sense of how people felt themselves about emotions and how they felt about others expressing emotion.
And the most common emotion people had experienced over the past year was frustration at work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's not surprising. I conducted the surveys, you know, during the kind of nadir of the recession. And I think at that point, everybody in America felt like they were, if they were lucky enough to still have jobs, were doing twice the work with half the resources. And could barely bring their head up to breathe air, let alone think about anything. So the frustration was a very clear emotion there. Might be different if it were if a survey were done 2 years from now.
Yeah, and close to half of us had felt anxiety. Was that all tied into the insecurity in the economy, or was it just anxiety over work itself?
Well, I think it's both. It was fascinating for me to sort of, again, go into the research of the science of anxiety. And anxiety is kind of our earliest warning, like the canary in the coal mine, for something that might be up. So anxiety can be, in any circumstance, a person who may feel, I'm not competitive enough anymore, or that other person seems to be taking credit for my work, but how do I articulate this? I mean, there's a range of stuff that doesn't have to do with the uncertainty of the economy, and is individual to each person's job. But it is about uncertainty. It is about vagueness, and it produces this kind of chronic hormonal overdose that can be really destabilizing for people.
Women are more likely than men to feel angry at work, but men are more likely to feel entitled to express that anger. Where's the disconnect there?
I think there's two pieces there. One is that women want to get angry at work in ways that they feel kind of socially prevented from doing so. You know, it still is in the workplace, even with women being over 50% of the workforce, senior management still tends to be more male. So if one is being, if one feels sort of vaguely victimized in a situation like that with a male superior, it would be, and I had experienced this myself, a kind of professional suicide in their minds to express their anger. And so they feel hamstrung to do it. And in fact, interestingly enough, Victoria Breskel at Yale University studied this. When women are faced with that and they feel like they can't express their righteous anger, what they fall into is tears, which is the more sort of socially acceptable expression of something important having happened. Historically, and again in these kind of studies from Yale, people view men who are angry as having greater power and greater status. So I think young men in the workplace have had this as the kind of operating norm and the kind of paradigm in the workforce, and they still think that that's actually true, even though all my research said no one likes anger in the workplace.
And one thing you did discover was that anger is really only tolerated in one direction, from a higher-ranking employee to a lower-ranking one, regardless of gender.
Yeah, and even then, it's not it's not really tolerated. It's at least it's viewed as normal on some level, and anger is a very demotivating emotion. It doesn't sort of spur people to excellence.
And of all the other emotions that you found great tolerance for, as we sort of skated around, anger does not fall into that category. People don't think it's great that people are free to express anger at work.
No, and in fact, it's often used, it's a punitive kind of thing. Now, there are people I cite in my book who have, used anger as a way to kind of drive their own personal excellence. And as I mentioned earlier, there's, in fact, a woman who I talk about a lot in the empathy chapter, she runs landside operations at Miami International Airport. Empathy and kind of an anger on behalf of the underdog, the disenfranchised, is also a good thing. But anger, when it's directed at somebody in the sense of you're not living up to, my expectations, or you're under-delivering or whatever it can be, usually is a sign that the person who's delivering the anger is in a state of stress and feeling, pressured and out of control and doesn't really know what to do with it themselves.
So, as you mentioned, women sometimes will cry out of anger or frustration or other emotions as well at work. More than four times more likely than men to cry at work. Does that track with how much more often women cry in general?
Yeah, it's almost exactly consistent with that. And, as I mentioned earlier, some of this is sort of hormonally tied. Some of it is socially tied because, of the sense of kind of boundaries within the workplace. It's just a fact of life. And that's one of the things I feel like the association of shame and crying in the workplace for women harkens back to when in the 60s we first started going to work in significant numbers with the equal opportunity, right? And since men were the dominant force in the workplace at that point, to be equal at that time meant to act like a man. So we went into the workplace, not really understanding that, you know, men's behavior is kind of biologically wired to be less emotionally expressive. You know, they do cry less. They don't have the same amount of hormone in their bodies. And we adopted that. And I think the knowledge that has come from scientific sort of inquiry in the last decade can sort of say, wait a minute, you know, we can embrace this. It's a fact of life. It's our most natural emotional reset button. Because when you cry, you produce dopamine and it boosts your mood. And, you know, it's a way of expressing feelings. And it's not something shameful.
I thought it was so interesting, Anne, that men who see female colleagues cry don't necessarily, you know, disdain them for that. But women are really tough on other women who open up.
Yeah, it's really true. And it's linked to what I was just talking about a second ago, which I think is this sense that, you know, I was probably the second or third, you know, late third generation of women going to work after the equal opportunity rights. And when I went to work, I started as a banker, and it was very clearly, you know, you man up and you never let them see you cry. And God forbid, if you do have to cry, you go into the bathroom. And that's just this kind of, I think, vestigial thing that percolates in the atmosphere. And women are still their harshest judges, while men have let go of it. They're like, we're all human beings. Fine, this happens. We get it.
You share a really candid story about a time when you were at the top of your game professionally, and then sort of out of nowhere, there was kind of a switchback, and you got yelled at by none other than Sumner Redstone.
Yeah, I was at the time 37, and I had just completed the largest deal of its kind, in fact, to distribute video and audio for a Nickelodeon television series. And I was celebrating with my colleagues in my office, and the phone rings, and my assistant said, you know, oh, it's Sumner, line one. And I'm like, oh, awesome, he's calling to congratulate. What a great boss. How fabulous could this be? And then he just, you know, laid into me because I had failed to make the Viacom stock price move. Hmm. And it was so stunning in its ferocity and its kind of brevity. You know, 90 seconds after he called me, he slammed the phone down without a goodbye, that it really just shocked me. And I think many of us, you know, in work environments have been stunned when that kind of explosive anger comes at you from nowhere. And I did what women do, couldn't get angry at him, and started to cry, but it was in front of my colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
Which felt to me like even a doubly humiliating kind of moment.
Yeah, there's also that thing that, you know, we're taught not to give someone else the satisfaction of letting them see us cry. And he wasn't there, but did it sort of feel the same that your colleagues witnessed this?
Well, it was a disturbing thing because we had done something terrific, and the people in the office had really put in long hours and, you know, had crafted something magnificent. And so I was in this double bind because they still deserved their, you know, reward for a job well done. And so it became this very complicated kind of emotional landscape in basically 10 seconds, you know. So, yes, it was problematic because I was in front of them. Not so much that I felt ashamed for it, but I didn't know how to not let them down
mm-hmm.
by the behavior.
We're going to take a quick break, after which we will talk a little bit more about the workplace emotion evaluation profile and what that, you know, can reveal about your comfort, our individual comfort with expressing emotion, and also with our colleagues doing the same thing. My guest this hour is Anne Kramer. She's former executive vice president and worldwide director of Nickelodeon. Her new book is called It's Always Personal: Emotion in the New Workplace. Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Anne Kramer. She's former executive vice president and worldwide creative director of Nickelodeon. She has been a regular columnist for Fast Company and Martha Stewart Living magazines. Her new book is called It's Always Personal: Emotion in the New Workplace. So let's talk about the Workplace Emotion Evaluation Profile, the acronym for which, of course, is WEEP, the WEEP profile. There are four basic types it identifies, and it's sort of a Myers-Briggs kind of test.
It is, but it grew out of the first survey that we did, where we were trying to get kind of a snapshot of what people were actually feeling in a real workplace environment. I mean, one of the interesting things as I started sort of probing this subject is that research in terms of emotion tends to kind of fall into academics working within laboratory situations, which never reflect the kind of, oh, my God, you know, my kid woke up with a runny nose, we were late to the office, you know, we were late to school, then I got stuck in a truck, you know, all the things that we bring into the office with us, you know, my mother's right. coming to dinner tonight, all that. So they don't actually reflect reality, or they tend to be from academics who have never really held line jobs. So I was trying to sort of explore those things in the first survey. Coming out of that, we realized that the answers of the respondents tended to kind of fall into these four categories you mentioned. And I named them, you know, spouters, acceptors, believers, and solvers. What was fascinating to us about the second survey, which was about 800 people that were involved, is that it was absolutely equally divided between the genders in terms of fitting into those four different quadrants. And it was almost equally divided in terms of income level. There was a very slight advantage to solvers in terms of being slightly higher income, and slightly more of them were CEOs or top management. But otherwise, being part of any one of the quadrants is not a sign of anything other than the ways that I've named them and sort of identifiers for basic personality traits.
And there are really, it sounds like, pros and cons to each type.
Yeah, there are. And, you know, like all things, we're all kind of a spectrum. When I took the survey, I ended up being a spouter predominantly and then a solver. And spouters are people who tend to wear their emotions on their sleeves. They have a very high tolerance, in fact, for other people's emotional displays. But they tend to take slights kind of personally in things. And as I did research around sort of anxiety and different other aspects of emotion, I think it's probably, you know, a spouter might be described as someone slightly thin-skinned, but they also are enthusiastic. They view themselves as creative, and they think of themselves as good leaders. Solvers tend to be people who do their best work under stress, and they like to sort of approach problems programmatically and, like, pull them apart and dissect them, but they can also be kind of bossy and overweening and domineering. Believers are the kind of people who get a lot of their satisfaction in life from larger meanings and things. They tend to be people who are more religious or who have mission-driven kind of aspects to their work. But that can also lead them to kind of step out and not necessarily engage in the actual day-to-day work process as much as they might. And then finally, acceptors, which was slightly younger, again, in slightly a larger cohort, are people who tend to just sort of sit back. They think luck is more responsible for the things they do. They think diplomacy is more important than truthfulness. Some might describe acceptors as slightly passive-aggressive, but they're also people who question authority and question things and can be essential to an organization's ability to kind of, you know, not get in over its head.
I took the short online version that's available on our page, the link to your page, and I was a solver first and then a believer.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of emotion, solver, I thought, really nailed me, because I'm comfortable with other people being emotional around me, but I don't like to give anything up myself.
Well, that I'm glad to know it. It was accurate. And again, these are not meant to be, you know, things that pigeonhole you in any way.
Right.
What I wanted to try and offer, I think the book is about both understanding where emotion comes from and then trying to offer people different kinds of strategies to help themselves manage it better. So I know I can't be responsible for your behavior, but I can actually be responsible for how I view your behavior. And, you know, that's a lot of, you know, I don't think I need to change myself particularly. I don't need to become somebody other than a spouter solver. But if I figure out how to work with someone else who might be an acceptor believer, that's helpful to me in terms of my professional.
Do different categories tend to work particularly well together?
No, not in anything that we particularly found. I mean, I think you need a combination of all. I mean, I actually, in my mind's eye, I now think the Beatles are a perfect example of all four quadrants. You know, John was very clearly kind of a spouter, very political, out there doing his thing, you know, with Yoko, just pedal to the metal. Paul was, I think, sort of the solver, the practical one, getting things done, doing everything. Ringo, kind of classic acceptor in my mind. And George, you know, duh, I'm a believer. I mean, but you needed all four of them, or you wouldn't have had the Beatles. And I think work is like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Ann Kramer is my guest. We're talking about her new book, It's Always Personal, Emotion in the New Workplace. Let's go to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Max in Rockwall. Hi, Max.
Hello, Chris and Ann.
Hi.
My comment is about intense emotions in the workplace sometimes enter in. I lost a child a few years ago, and I work with a colleague who experienced the same thing about a year ago or so. And I'm managing this as well as could be expected, and so is my other colleague. But unfortunately, one day, this other person's manager came up to me as sort of a peer and asked me if there was a problem. He was thinking that this other person should be over their grief by now. And he noticed that one of the ladies in his group had commented to him that she thought he should be over his grief, and that he was still crying occasionally. And I made it certain, no uncertain terms, that that there was no timeline for this kind of thing, and that just because she was a female did not provide her with the unendowed expertise to just comment on these things.
Yeah.
Well, so this was a case of sort of a misogynistic approach getting in the way of what people were dealing with.
My heart breaks for you and what you went through, and I actually address something slightly comparable in my book to when I was working and my father died, and then 6 months later my mother and my grandmother died on the same day. It's, for my mind, nothing's the equivalent of a child, but I don't think it's so much misogynistic behavior that you might be talking about, but that no one in work is ever taught or equipped to help people through these difficult transitions that all of us are going to go through. It's a guarantee that because we're all going to be working vastly longer than we've ever thought we were going to be working, that all these kinds of things are going to come up and slam us down. And one of the things I talk about in the book a bit is, I wish I had been smarter about going to my colleagues and to my bosses to say, you know what, I'm going through a really rough time. Why don't you, boss, help me figure out how I can manage taking my leave of absences to deal with my dying parents, or what I can do? You know, let's be proactive about it. And then at the same time, you know, here's what I need from you, you know. And I don't think we're taught this, and I think it's one of the big points about how we deny the emotion that's going on in the workplace at the expense of the well-being of all the individuals in the workplace and at the expense of the well-being of the company, ultimately. Because I have no doubt you were, a valuable asset, and that figuring out how to address this is essential.
And work relationships are so important, particularly when big things are happening. You know, it's almost like people assume that no one at work is a real friend, but in fact, you are with these people more waking hours sometimes than anyone else in your life.
Well, and in today's environment where all of us literally are working 24/7 and feel that kind of permeable, it's all transparent and permeable and there all the time, I think it's ludicrous to assume that emotions get checked at the door. I think it, if you cannot bring your full essential self into work, and that includes sometimes when you are grieving, how are we going to prosper?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Danny in Plano, who wants to know whether House Speaker John Boehner is making it more acceptable for a man to cry in public.
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think, one of the other things in my research that we discovered is that people fall into sort of two categories first out of the box. I interviewed 200 people across the country, ranging from like CEOs to waitresses working on the Navajo Nation. And in that spectrum, people would consistently open their interview saying, well, I'm a crier, or I'm not a crier. So right now, John Boehner is clearly a member of the crying tribe.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's actually a person who could benefit from figuring out when he knows these triggers are going to happen for him, because he is in such a high-profile leadership position. you know, anytime anybody talks about achievement and coming up from nothing and persevering and all the stuff that's of the American dream that he obviously feels deep emotional resonance with, that's when his triggers come off, you know. He's been lambasted for perhaps not having the same kind of empathy towards his fellow man that he seems to have about his own life story. But yes, I think a little bit. I mean, I think if you look at Glenn Beck, I mean, Lawrence O'Donnell last night on his MSNBC show had a whole sort of bit about how he had teared up when he was reading an email from a woman talking about Planned Parenthood and the services that it had provided to her when there was talk of it being, you know, cut in the budget cuts. So I think men are feeling like they can express their emotion and their compassion in a way that wasn't true probably for our fathers' generations.
It's funny, though. I think about that, and then I think about, you know, the incident when Hillary Clinton teared up on the presidential campaign trail. And on the one hand, people said, well, she's stressed, she's busy, she's having a moment of strong emotion. And yet there was this instant flurry of questions about whether she was stable enough and able to handle the pressure. And no one's asked that about John Boehner.
No, although I think there actually it creeps in a little bit. What I actually think, though, about Hillary Clinton in the New Hampshire moment when the woman asked her, you know, how do you do it, was the turning point for her in winning the New Hampshire primary. Mm-hmm. Because when she teared up and sort of revealed her basic humanity, people thought, oh, wow, she is human. She's more like me. I get it. Okay, I'm comfortable with this. And that's a lot of the point, I think, with the 88% of people who say they want and they value the expression of emotion. It connects you to your fellow man. I mean, anger and anxiety and fear were the emotions that are kind of located in our amygdala, the primitive parts of our brain. They're the emotions that, you know, you say, is that a snake in the road or a stick in the road? Well, if it's a snake, I better jump, right? Mm-hmm. The other emotions that are kind of connected in the prefrontal cortex part of our brain are, you know, compassion and empathy and the things that sort of help the survival of the species. They connect us to our fellow man. They're very, very important, and I don't think we devote nearly enough time to kind of nourishing and cultivating them in the workplace as we actually should, because they're perceived as soft and squishy.
Have we gone too far in very valiantly and appropriately trying to avoid sexual harassment to the extent that it's not okay to give somebody a pat on the back anymore at work?
I think there's an argument to be made, and, you know, I've worked in very rough situations in my life as a salesperson over the years, and experienced some of that. I also think we've kind of gone the wrong direction in terms of the litigiousness of our society. I think particularly during the recession, when so many people were laid off from their work, the human resources function of organizations tended to be more about how can I do this without getting sued, mm-hmm. rather than how can we let someone, or fire them. I don't even like the euphemism of letting go. How can we fire someone and give them some human dignity? And a lot of that granting of human dignity, I think, comes from acknowledging pain and suffering.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Sam in Fort Worth. Hi, Sam.
Hey, it's me.
Hi.
I just had a comment about working in a federal and state position. I worked investigations for Child Protective Services in a low-income town and located in Central Texas, high crime rate, so on and so forth. And you wouldn't believe the burnout rate. I think when I was hired there around 2004, I think investigators lasted no longer than about 9 months.
Wow.
And, I worked there for about 5.5 years and eventually just burnt myself out. The sad part is that there is no attempt by the state to assess their workers at the hiring point to see where they would be most effective in the various positions of dealing with a highly emotionally charged environment. I mean, you're dealing with people's children, right?
Yeah.
This isn't, you're not trying to work up through the ranks by getting a good deal and closing the deal and things of that nature. There's no money involved in your work.
You're never going to have an easy day on that job.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Anne?
Well, I think Sam's talking about something that's, you know, obviously that's the front lines of just the degree of emotional, you know, involvement in your day-to-day job. but no one's taught strategies for emotional resilience either. I think you're absolutely correct that employees should be assessed before they are hired into a position like that to see if they're a reasonable fit and if they do seem to have some resiliency, because otherwise it's just terrible for everybody concerned. But there are also ways to help people figure out how to dissociate from some of the stuff that you might see on the job and to kind of rebuild your sense of self and ground out that probably you're not instructed in either. Am I right in that?
Let me bring him back on the line. Is that correct, Sam?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
I would say that it's not emphasized, and it really boils down to money. It boils down to can you convince the state to pay for this kind of teaching and education? Now, there's extended teaching and education, but it's not really on how to take care of yourself so much or how to navigate the minefield of emotional problems you're going to encounter on the job. And it just boils down to the overwhelming volume of problems that state workers are expected to deal with in a very snappy manner. It's a sinking ship. I mean, I'm not gonna paint a pretty picture for you.
Right.
Well, let's take a quick break, and Ann, you can comment further on Sam's situation if you're interested in just a moment. My guest is Ann Kramer, former executive vice president and worldwide creative director of Nickelodeon. Her new book is called It's Always Personal, Emotion in the New Workplace. If you want to take the Workplace Emotion Evaluation Profile, it's available now. A link to it on the Think page of KERA.org. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@KERA.org. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Nickelodeon Executive Vice President and Worldwide Creative Director Ann Kramer. She's also been a regular columnist for Fast Company and Martha Stewart Living magazines. Her new book is called It's Always Personal, Emotion in the New Workplace. Before the break, Ann, we had Sam describing the reality that it's just expensive to provide that kind of sort of emotional background checking and support later on for employees, but the rate of turnover he was describing is also very expensive.
Well, precisely the point I was going to make, but I was also going to make what I think is an interesting observation, that the people who've called in so far are all men.
Hmm.
And, you know, I think that this actually speaks, you know, loudly and clearly to the fact that all of us are interested in figuring out, you know, how to deal with emotions in the workplace. And it's not just the, you know, quote-unquote more emotional gender women who are navigating their ways in this, you know, modern, confusing world and trying to figure out how to be real and grounded. So I think that's fascinating. It's been fascinating.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Julie who says, while showing some emotion at work may be beneficial, coworkers who constantly say, I love you to each other within earshot of everyone are driving me crazy. Is this behavior unprofessional or inappropriate, and what is a tactful way to get them to stop? Is it possible to be too kind to one's coworkers?
Well, you know, Julie's question may connect to the trend in our culture about parents always telling their children that they're great and, you know, T-ball or something. You know, I don't really know, and I don't know the specifics of her work environment to know if it's too aggressive or not. I mean, very different work environments have very different sort of norms. I mean, what was like for me when I was a banker was very different for what the environment was for me when I was at MTV Networks, which was a, you know, hard partying, hard swearing, Yahoo kind of an organization. But I think that's an example where if she has issues with it, maybe she talks to her colleagues and says, you know, can we notch it back a bit? Or, you know, tries to see if, in fact, she's the one out of sync with everybody else in an organization who's in that kind of, you know, cheerfulness. And if that's the case, does she still feel comfortable there?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it until I read your book, but the emotional climate of a workplace is as much part of workplace culture as anything else, including how you dress or what the working hours are, things like that.
Very much so. And in fact, you know, part of, you know, a lot of sort of a theme through the book is kind of what's called metacognition, or thinking about thinking on some level, and self-reflection. And I think one of the things, you know, I knew I was not a banker at heart when I had the job, but it, you know, paid my rent and it was a good learning curve and all sorts of different things. So I think a lot of navigating professional life is trying to figure out the environments where you actually will prosper. So instead of trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, you try and find opportunities where, you know, you get to be, you know, who you are and bring your best self to work.
Talk about this, though. I was really surprised to read that, you know, typically you'd think if someone cries at work more than, you know, once every few years, it must be a sign that they're unhappy. But that's not the case.
No. And in fact, again, I was just, you know, kind of flabbergasted because it seems so counterintuitive. But in our survey, the people who reported that they had cried to work said that they weren't unhappy, which is, again, tears are this kind of reset valve that we have. I mean, you know, when we were our first tool of communication from when we were infants, and all parents can tell the difference between a hurt cry, a hungry cry, or a tired cry. I mean, they're actually, you know, sonically different to the parents' ears. Same is kind of true, I think, as adults. You know, we can have tears of frustration, awe, joy, you know, anger. So I think each person, you know, may be overwhelmed for a different reason in the workplace, and the tears will come out and the reset valve will happen, and then onward they go. Doesn't mean they're unhappy. Just means they had this moment that they should pay a little bit of attention to and say, gosh, that's interesting. I wonder why I did that.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Leslie in Dallas. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I have a quick question. I wonder if your book deals with this. I'm married to someone who works in the mortgage business, and it's so volatile right now, and we're fairly young, and he was a VP. I don't want to name companies or anything. But now this company just lays off people left and right, and you never know when it's going to happen. And basically, from my standpoint as being former management, I think they do it as like a tool to steer these people into accepting less pay, working longer hours, etc. My husband's even scared to say anything to his boss at all, you know,
yeah,
if there's something wrong. How do you get out of that situation?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it sounds to me like a fairly toxic environment that you're describing right now in terms of management kind of almost encouraging that sense of kind of ambiguity and not knowing when the other shoe's going to drop. I do have several different interviews within the book of people in that situation, and I do talk about how you can kind of address your own personal free-floating anxiety. You know, pilots employ something called situational awareness, which is a really sort of strategic way of looking at, you know, a wide scope of things instantaneously, and I suggest that people can do their own kind of situational awareness protocols, even if they're not pilots. So I address it in some ways, but nothing as specific as dealing with that individual environment, particularly in something as, you know, tumultuous as the mortgage industry right now.
What are the takeaways of this research, Anne, for managers and for HR professionals who do want to set an appropriate tone in the workplace?
I think that being, you know, honest that these things are there, being clear that there are actually, you know, establishing protocols to kind of help people deal with this. Like, for instance, no one's ever taught how to deal with somebody crying in their office. Most people clam up, or they're embarrassed, or, you know, don't know how to deal with it. I think if you were in HR, it would be an extremely important lesson to sort of teach people how to do that. And, you know, it's acknowledging what's going on. It's giving them, you know, a tissue and saying, here, sit with it for a moment, and then let's get to it. But most people flee. Like, somebody cries, and they run out of the room, and they never go back to what's going on. You know, learning what kinds of emotional behavior are signals that something's going on. It's like, you know, the headlights on your dashboard in your car, if the check engine light goes off,
mm-hmm,
you better get to the shop. I mean, I think a lot of emotional expressiveness in companies is very similar. If a large group of your employees are getting angry, or if you're crying a lot, you know, something's up. Figure it out and then, you know, develop the tools or the strategies to try and address it.
We're putting duct tape over the check engine light.
Yeah, exactly, and just assuming it'll go away.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will go out to McKinney and speak with Deborah. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My question is, I didn't come into the beginning of the show, but I heard about the four quadrants, and I have a kind of an idea of which one I fall into. And my question is, which ones have the most trouble are the ones that get, you know, get into HR issues or get reprimanded more or get have a better chance of getting fired or, you know, I'm curious about that.
No one is particularly negative. I would suggest, and I'm of this quadrant, so I can speak with some authority, that the spouters might have more of the issue because they tend to kind of shoot from the hip. So to the degree that they're tolerant of other emotional displays, they might occasionally have, you know, expressive displays of their own that make people uncomfortable. But in general, the same can happen with people who withhold information or people who sort of check out or people who kind of are, you know, imperious. So no one is more problematic than the other in particular.
What's interesting about these types is once you, and there's great descriptions of them in the book and going into much more detail than we're able to in this conversation, but I think most of us are able to look at most of our colleagues and say, I bet you're a spouter. I bet you're a believer. I bet you're a solver.
Yeah. And I think, you know, probably we're right. I think one of the things that would be fun to do would be, you know, ask your friends and colleagues to take the test about yourself and see if your self-diagnosis is actually as close as other people's perceptions. But in the book, I also offer sort of, you know, if you find that you are defaulting to one of these more and you think it's getting in the way of your work, to sort of go back to the last question, there are strategies you can use to kind of help you overcome that. Or if you're chronically dealing with somebody who's, you know, exploding at you all the time, I also offer suggestions for ways you can talk to them and maybe, you know, change the nature of the dialogue.
And you're not saying in the book that it's not disruptive if someone's coming in every day with some kind of emotional crisis.
No. And I think, you know, those are situations that, like I mentioned earlier, that if I were a manager, somebody who was really having, you know, that would be like, you know, let's have a conversation. Let's try and talk about what's going on. Now, these are, we all, you know, if a couple times a year you tear up at work, that's completely normal. No one should feel ashamed of that.
And it's also not an impediment to getting ahead in the world.
No. Well, hello, John Boehner. But no, the fact of the matter is that throughout all levels of management, you know, CEOs admitted to tearing up on the job just as much as, you know, the busboy did. There was no stigma attached to crying at all. And that, again, I think is the perception. You know, you cry and you're out of here. Well, that's very old school.
Do we need to come back and apologize after we've cried?
No, I don't think so. I think after you get angry, it's probably a very good idea to apologize because that's coming from some other place. I think if you know, someone cries, it's appropriate to go and kind of have a conversation about what happened, what was the catalyst for it, what was, you know, is there a solution to something, you know, to address it and not deny it. It's back to that check engine light, you know. You don't cry for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Joy, it's an emotional expression.
Joy and empathy obviously are always okay.
Yep.
Talk about how women in particular can lay off each other.
I think just becoming aware of all these things is, you know, we're never taught it. It's never discussed. We aren't aware of the fact that we're actually being, I think, as hard on each other as we tend to be. You know, I think now that I believe we're at this sort of unique moment in time where, for the first time, yes, we're over 50% of the workforce, and that's this opportunity to kind of pull back and say, can we reinvent workplace norms? You know, when the generation of senior management older men retire, I think we're going to see a transformation in the workplace. So what do we want that to be like? Can we be leaders in that way and create something that works for everybody in a better way?
I think it's interesting that so much about the workplace has already changed. We are more informal in the way we address one another, in the way, in most workplaces, in how we come dressed to work, in the way we work together in teams. Why do you think this one has lagged behind the other things that we have adjusted according to our current needs?
I think it's actually evolutionary. You know, as I talked about earlier, our amygdala, the amygdala is on alert constantly to assess threat, right? So we evaluate aggression or competition in the workplace as if it were a physical threat and go on, and all of our kind of hormones just, you know, shoot anything, and the message is going from the amygdala to the prefrontal cortex are faster and deeper and more powerful than the prefrontal cortex's ability to kind of step back and say, oh, right, she's just questioning whether my project is, you know, feasible. She's not actually sort of she's not trying to kill me. And we have not evolutionarily caught up with it yet, I think. We don't know how to assess cognitive threat in a way that, you know, deal with cognitive threat in an appropriate way that isn't fight or flight.
Have responses you've received to the book tracked pretty closely with what we've observed today, which is that a lot of men are as interested in changing the way the workplace operates as women?
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, you know, the book's been out now 2 weeks, and in that 2 weeks, I've received so much mail from men saying, kind of, you know, thank you, both from the, gee whiz, I never had a clue.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to walk into work with my, you know, eyes wider open and feel kind of more confident, to also, thanks, I've been feeling this stuff and feeling like, you know, gosh, am I not like a normal guy?
So maybe instead of having that bowl of candy on our desk to draw people in for a chat, we should put a box of Kleenex on the desk.
Well, or, you know, who knows what, but yeah. Maybe both.
Ann Kramer is former executive vice president and worldwide creative director of Nickelodeon, and she's also been a regular columnist for Fast Company magazine and for Martha Stewart magazine. Her new book is called It's Always Personal, Emotion in the New Workplace. If you want to take that WEEP survey, it's available as a link on the Think page of KERA.org. And really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was a terrific conversation.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.